Well, good morning, everybody. It's a privilege and a pleasure to be with you this morning. My name's Phil. I'm one of the ministers here. It's a great privilege to be speaking, particularly this morning, on the dedication of Avene. It's great to see that. And a special warm welcome to those of you who are here as family and as friends. A bit of family announcement, really. I'd like to publish the banns of marriage, in particular, between Andrew Martin Miller of St. Agnes, Kennington Park, and Catherine Trenner Donaldson of St. Mary's, Twickenham. This is for the second time of asking. If you know any reason in law why they may not marry each other, you are to declare it. I think Catherine is here, is that right? Give us a wave, Catherine. Where are you? Hello, bless you. Can we pray for you? Is that all right? Why don't we just stretch out a hand to Catherine? Lord, we thank you so much for Catherine and for Andrew. Would you bless them? Would you pour out your spirit on them and prepare them in all ways necessary for that which is to come, their marriage. Amen. Bless you. Well, this morning we're talking about living stones. I don't know if you know the band The Rolling Stones. They've sold 55 albums, released 55 albums even. Sold? You'd think, yeah, they did quite well, didn't they, really? Start how you mean to go on. Released 55 albums, sold over 200 million records. It's said that they have given more live concerts than any other existing band in the world. And they took their name, I don't know if you know, from the 1962 Muddy Waters song entitled Rolling Stone, which talks about a young boy who just moves from place to place. And this emphasis on Rolling Stones has kind of gone into, the musical world. Some of you may know other songs. Papa Was a Rolling Stone, the great Motown hit. Dylan sang a song like a Rolling Stone. So Rolling Stones is a theme that we might be familiar with. But living stones, this term living stones, is something that we might be a little less familiar with and occurs in this passage that we're looking at in 1 Peter. We've been traveling through the book of 1 Peter. We started a few weeks ago, written, as you may remember, as Will described, by Peter the Apostle, this guy who was picked out of nowhere by Jesus, who walked on water, who denied Christ, who was there speaking at Pentecost, saw thousands of people come to faith, was persecuted, suffered, and eventually, we believe, martyred upside down, crucified upside down in Rome, in around AD 64, there or thereabouts. This is the man who wrote this letter that we're looking at. And it's a letter that focuses on suffering. The readers of this letter, the people who it was written to, were going through a tough time. They were, in all likelihood, suffering, probably being persecuted to some degree or other. And in the light of that, in this context, Peter describes them as living stones. So this morning, what I want to do is just unpack that a little. Why did he describe them like this? What does that mean, and what's its significance to us today? 3 points I'd like to make very simply. Firstly, he's trying to convey to them, you're secure. You're secure. All the way through this letter, Peter keeps referring to Jesus. Just in the first chapter that we've already looked at, he speaks about the concept of hope, and he says, Jesus is our hope. His resurrection is the cause for our hope. He will return again. There is hope that we can lean on. He speaks about holiness, again refers to the person of Jesus as our example. And so when we get to the beginning of chapter 2, as we are in now, unsurprisingly, he starts talking about Jesus again. And he describes him as the living stone. Living stone is a bit of an oxymoron, isn't it? It's a combination of words that appears contradictory, a bit like airline food, or numb sensation, or succinct preachers, for example. But by combining these two words together, he's trying to say something very deliberate. Because in terms of stone, he would be reminding his Jewish readers of all the prophecies that occur in the Old Testament about the Messiah being a stone. The Messiah is referred to as a cornerstone, a capstone. So when he uses this term, in the reader's ears, the Jewish reader's ears in particular, they'd be thinking Messiah, Messiah. And he's saying Jesus too has the characteristics of stone. He's solid, he's sure, he's an ideal person on which to build your life as a foundation, someone in whom you can put your trust. I don't know how you're feeling about the position Greece is in at the moment, their security as a country, whether or not they will remain in the euro, in the EU at all, how that makes you feel. For me, it raises all sorts of questions. What is the future of Europe? Will we be in it? Where are we going? It calls us to question our own security. The Archbishop of Canterbury a few years ago said, all the great institutions in which we have trusted have fallen. Think about it. Government, ruling class, education, NHS, the media, even the church. Flaws are exposed. We may have put our trust in these great institutions in the past. Now, it seems as though that's a very frightening thing to do. I don't know about you, I'm looking for someone or something that is secure. Someone or something that has a great track record. Someone or something in whom I can say, yeah, they've delivered. Someone or something in whom they have the resources to deliver. Someone or something who has an inherent goodness that can't be corrupted. That's what I'm looking for in terms of the institutions, in terms of people, in terms of Jesus. And I found him to be true. I found him to be secure. Peter says we can lean on him. We can rely on him. We can put our trust in him. I wonder what you're putting your trust in this morning. Because you are putting your trust in something. And is it secure? Is it solid? Will it stand up to pressure? Peter says this stone of Jesus isn't just solid, but he said it's living. It's a living stone. And here the metaphor really excels because he's actually saying this stone, it's kind of dead thing in and of itself, a bit like Jesus was when he died. But Jesus is saying, you know, in and of that, it's now alive. It's as if the stone itself has come to life because Jesus brings life. There's that famous passage that John speaks about where Jesus says, I've come to give you life, life in all of its fullness. And our lives often don't feel that full, do they? Jeremy Clarkson, been in the news again this week as his successor has been appointed to the position in terms of presenting Top Gear, Chris Evans. Jeremy said this, we get up, trudge through the day, go to bed and keep going till we die. That's his view on life. And you know, our attempts at doing life, doing it well on our own terms, are often hopeless, aren't they? Literally. Our poor decisions lead us into trouble. They sap the life out of us so that we are half dead. And Peter's saying, you know what, we've got this living stone here, and we can come and we can place our lives on the living stone. And then it's almost as if, like, sort of as a result of capillary action, we suck the life out of him and life enters us. But we have to be on top of the living stone, resting on him. I wonder if that's where you are this morning. Some of you might never have come and chosen to place your life on Jesus. Some of you may have chosen to do that at some points in time, but actually you've drifted, because you need to be really close to Jesus to know his life. You need to be resting on him. Where are you? Where are you? Is your life based on him? For much of his life, the writer and commentator A.N. Wilson rejected Christianity. He wrote a book called Jesus, where he tried to prove that this man who lived 2,000 years ago had failed and simply died. But he writes, as time passed, I found myself going back to church. At first, a fellow traveler with believers, but some time later, I couldn't tell you exactly when, I found I had changed. When I took part in the Easter procession and heard the gospel being chanted, I assented to it with complete simplicity. My belief has come about, he says, in a large measure because of the lives and example of people I know, people who have lived and faced death in quiet acceptance that they have a future after they die. And the Easter story reminds us that we're spiritual beings, he says. Every inner prompting of conscience, glimmering sense of beauty, response we make to music, every experience we have of love reminds us of our true selves. Easter meets reason and our hearts together, addresses the whole person. In the past, I've suggested Easter shouldn't be taken literally, but the more I read the story, the better it seems to fit and apply to the human condition. That's too why I now believe in it. We're spiritual people. There is spiritual life offered to us by Jesus. I wonder if you know that, whether you feel alive this morning in him. I'm going to pause at this point and just give you a moment to reflect on where you're at. And you might want to say to Jesus, who's here by his Spirit, I want your life. I want to be secure, perhaps for the first time. Or perhaps you just need to draw closer and say, I want to know more of your life. You just pray to Jesus. Say what you want to say to him now. The first thing Peter was saying to his readers is that you are secure because you're based on this living stone. The second thing he was saying is that you are special. You are being built, he says, into a spiritual house or a temple. You sit alongside other living stones. You're part of something bigger. You contribute to the beauty of the whole. Whatever your role, you're special. You might be one of those solid, strong, dependable, plain kind of stones, making up the base of the walls, hidden out of sight just below the earth. But the strength and the beauty of the building are dependent on you. Parents who love and cherish your children, bringing up the next generation of saints. We don't see much of your investment in your children. Most of it happens out of sight. But the hours of exhaustion, the loneliness, and the sacrifice are building a foundation in your children's lives. You may think God doesn't see. He does. So this morning, take heart, particularly if you're a parent and life is hard. I know a bit about what that's like. Take courage that you do have a place and a role in the church. Some of you may be beautiful stones, carefully cut and polished, catching the eye, the showpieces of the temple. And the rest of us might find ourselves thinking, God, I wish I could be like that stone. But think for a moment how that stone ended up like that. How its edges were knocked off, chiseled away. How it was sanded down, polished for weeks on end, with rough coming onto smooth. How that is a painful process. Think on that before you say, I wish I was like that stone. But for some here, it will feel like you're going through it at the moment. You are having your edges knocked off. You are being sanded down. You're being polished. It's not very comfortable. It's not a nice place to be. But take courage from the fact that you are being crafted into something that is beautiful in the eyes of God. And then there are those little stones, the tiny little ones that at first glance don't seem to have any place at all. And yet, those little stones are the ones that are used to fill up the gaps, to make the building weatherproof and waterproof, to make it safe and secure. So if you feel small this morning, if you feel as though you don't really have much to give, take courage from the fact that actually you are needed. There is a place for you. You have a vital role to make sure the church, this building of God, is safe, secure, weatherproof. There's a role for you too. And as a stone, you carry God's presence with you. You see, for Peter's Jewish listeners, for them, they're scattered miles from Jerusalem, the place where the temple was, the place that they had been taught to believe the presence of God dwelt. They're a long way from home. They're a long way from that place. And so for them, the thought that God could be with them, actually better than that, God is in them, is hugely encouraging. They themselves are the temple, Peter is saying. They themselves gathered together are the place where God's presence dwells. Just think on that for a moment. When we're gathered here, God's presence dwells amongst us. He's here now. And when we gather, he's with us because we are his stones, making up the temple of his presence. Sometimes church is a bit noisy and chaotic, isn't it? When you're handing out chocolate bars to men, it gets a little bit messy. My children just wanted to keep it. But God's here. His presence is here. And God goes with you as a living stone tomorrow. Whatever you'll be doing tomorrow. You carry the holy presence of God with you into your workplace, into your college, into your school, because you're a living stone. You have the ability to transform the ordinary into the extraordinary by virtue of his Spirit. You're special, very special. And the other thing that Peter points out is that you are a holy priest, he says. A holy priest offering spiritual sacrifices to God. Now, priests in Peter's day, were the ones who prayed for people, offered sacrifices for their sins, mediated on behalf of the people, and entered the holiest places in the building. They were a very select group from the tribe of Levites. They had particular rights, particular responsibilities. I'm a priest. You may not believe it, I am. And it's funny, when I work a lot with prisoners and with ex-offenders, many of them struggle to believe it. I don't know why, but they do. I'm a priest. You too are priests in God's eyes. Which means You're called to pray for people, which means you mediate God to others, which means you can enter into the holiest of holy places. You can know God, and he knows you. You're a priest. And as such, you're called to offer spiritual sacrifices to God, according to Peter. Spurgeon said this: "See what Jesus has made of you who believe in him. He's brought you into a heavenly priesthood, and you are today to stand at the spiritual altar and to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God by Jesus Christ. Will you pray? Will you praise? Will you love? These are the sacrifices with which God is well pleased." Will you do that? Do you do that? Does that characterize your life? Certainly prayer and praise are what God is looking for as an offering to him. When does that happen? What does that look like for you? Do you offer that to him? Not just in times like this, but other times too, in the midst of your ordinary everyday life. Eugene Peterson, in his translation of The Message, when he's looking at Romans 12, translates that particular passage like this: "Here's what I want you to do. Take your everyday, ordinary life, your sleeping, eating, going to work, walking around life, and place it before God as an offering. An offering. That you offer your ordinary, everyday life to God." Another way we can offer sacrifices to God, according to Paul in Philippians, is by being generous, especially to those in need. That's an acceptable offering, according to him in that passage. So this morning, as a priest, are you familiar with the holy place? Do you go into the Holy of Holies really often? Do you mediate God to people? Do you offer acceptable sacrifices to him? How's your prayer life, your praise life, your everyday ordinary offering to him? How's your generosity? Is God pleased with the sacrifice that you bring to him? So we've had a look at how, as living stones, we're secure. We've had a look at how we're special as part of this great temple, as priests. The third thing I want to say, the third thing and the final thing I'll focus on, is that we are very strange. Now, if you've been in the church a while, you won't need much convincing of that. We're quite an odd bunch, let's be honest. But Peter, in this letter, makes a lot of it. Okay? He says, "You're strangers in the world. Live your life as strangers here. You are aliens, you are strangers," he said, right through the letter. He keeps going on about the fact that you're odd. You're set apart. You're different from a spiritual perspective, because you've been reborn and entered a new way of living. And he continues to emphasize difference in this passage that we're looking at this morning. He said, "To you who believe, the living stone, Jesus, is really precious. But to those who don't believe, he's an offense, he's a stumbling block." It's really stark in this passage that we're looking at. Christians are very distinct in the way they focus on Jesus. They think he's precious to them. They place their trust in him. And yet, for many non-Christians, Jesus is a real offense. Polly Toynbee, the president of the British Humanist Association, writer, comedian, said this: Of all the elements of Christianity, the most repugnant is the notion of Christ who took our sins upon himself and sacrificed his body in agony to save our souls. Did we ask him to? He's an offence to many. And when you look at his life, he polarised opinion. It's a bit like that kind of Marmite effect, if you like. You know, either people loved Jesus, they gave everything, literally everything, their lives to Jesus, or else they tried to kill him. There are very few people who just sat on the fence as regard Jesus, which makes him a really interesting person to study. If you don't know much about Jesus, study him. Why? Why did he polarize opinion? But this distinctiveness that we as Christians have means we are subject to a temptation. It means we are tempted to pull down the shutters, close our doors in light of a hostile world. And when we do have to get out and rub shoulders with the world, we tend to be quite quiet. We tend not to speak out. We tend not to risk, because people can take offense at who we are. People can exclude us, persecute us. And Peter, in his letter, points out to a people who are actually experiencing suffering and persecution two things. He asks them to do two things. He says, I want you to speak and I want you to serve. Speak and serve. Verse 9, you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people belonging to God. There's no full stop there. That you might declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. That you might declare, announce, draw attention to, speak about. Some translations say the excellences of Christ. The other way you're looking at it is saying the virtues of Christ. That you might declare them. That's powerful language. Not to keep quiet about them, not to mumble about them, but to declare them. And then he continues in verse 12, as strangers live such good lives amongst the pagans that they will see your good deeds and glorify God. See your good deeds, you doing good, not just being good, being nice, but being good, doing good, being a force for good, pursuing good. And the early Christians seem to get this. They seem to grasp it. There was a letter written in the second century that described the early Christians like this. Christians are distinguished from others by neither country or language or customs which they observe, but they display to us a wonderful and confessedly striking method of life. As citizens, they share all things with others, yet endure all things as if foreigners. They marry, as do all. They beget children, but they don't destroy their offspring. They have a common table, but not a common bed. They pass their days on earth, but they're citizens of heaven. They obey the prescribed laws, but at the same time, surpass the laws by their lives. I wonder how we'd be described, how you'd be described. Because it seems to me life is getting harder for us as Christians. Jesus is, as I've illustrated, insulted in the public square. We're told we can no longer speak about our faith in some instances for fear of inciting religious hatred. Our views are dismissed because they're founded on faith, and that isn't legitimate in a secular society. Gunmen enter our churches and shoot down those at prayer. Now, it's nothing, nothing to what those who Peter was writing to was experiencing, but we still have a choice. Do we pull down the shutters and retreat? Or do we speak out, and do we serve as Peter has commanded us to do. You see, we have to do that. We have to be brave and courageous because that's our calling. The theologian Jürgen Moltmann said this: Christians can't put up with reality as it is. The combination of the promise of God's future world and the experience of his Spirit motivates us into action. Faith isn't characterized by an attitude of indifference or passivity towards the way our world is. Our call is not fulfilled by turning inwards to form some kind of spiritual community, but by immersing ourselves actively in the midst of this world's darkness and its most depraved corners as salt and light with potentially transforming impact. So this morning, can I ask you to examine your life? Have you pulled down the shutters as a Christian? Have you retreated? How do you spend your time? It's a good measure of what we deem to be important. Your free time. Do you speak out? Are you willing to speak up for him? And do you do good? You're called to serve this world. How are you serving? How are you being a force for good? We're strangers in this world. We're odd. But we're called to speak and we're called to serve. I'm going to end with a story based on an article by a chap called Matthew Paris. He's a writer for The Times. And some years ago, he wrote this article, which is entitled, "As an Atheist, I Truly Believe Africa Needs God." And he was brought up in Malawi. And on returning there, wrote this: "I recognize the enormous contribution the Christian mission makes to Africa. This contribution is over and above the work of secular NGOs, government projects, and international aid efforts. I used to believe what made the difference was the good works that were motivated by the missionary's faith, not the faith itself. But the Christians were always different. Far from having cowed or confined its converts, their faith appeared to have liberated them and relaxed them. There was a liveliness, a curiosity, an engagement with the world, a directness in their dealings with others that seemed to be missing in traditional African life. They stood tall. Education and training alone will not do. In Africa, Christianity changes people's hearts. It brings a spiritual transformation. The rebirth is real. The change is good. Removing Christian evangelism from the African equation may leave the continent at the mercy of a malign infusion of Nike, the witch doctor, the mobile phone, and the machete. God calls us to speak and to serve. Thank God for those people who travel to the far-flung places of the world to speak and to serve. Because as they do, people come to life. They stand tall and they know what it is to live.